You say the standard definition of creativity is completely wrong. What makes you say that?
Well, for thousands of years, I think we've seen creativity as this single mode of thought, and that some people have it. Those are those wacky creative types. And the rest of us are just doomed to repeat their inventions, that creativity is this all or nothing phenomena, and that most of us just don't have it. And that just isn't the case. What you actually discover when you look at creativity from the perspective of the brain is that creativity is actually a catch-all term for a series of distinct mental processes. You know, sometimes we have epiphanies in the shower, and sometimes we chug Red Bull and caffeine and just keep on working and working and working. So there are many different ways to get to the answer. And, you know, the particular approach we should seek at that moment should depend on the type of creative problem we're trying to solve. And, you know, what you also discover is that creativity is embedded very deep in our programming code. Creativity is really this fundamental trait of human nature. We are all naturally creative. We are connection machines.
Now, are you saying that different things happen in the brain to spur us to be creative? I mean, it's not just a one-size-fits-all. There are different parts of the brain that get tapped?
That's exactly right. So depending on the type of creativity you're engaging in at that moment, different parts of the brain are going to be involved. So the imagination doesn't have a single substrate. The imagination is really a series of distinct networks within your head.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some examples here. You write about Bob Dylan about the time when he was really burned out. I mean, he actually – this was back in the 60s. You know, he'd already become a huge –
Late spring, name. 1965.
But he talked about actually giving up music at that point. He seemed to be sick of it all. And so what happened?
Yeah, so this is this interesting moment in Bob Dylan's career where he's transitioning from being primarily a folk singer, singing on political themes, writing classic songs, iconic songs like The Times They Are Changing, Blown in the Wind – and he's sick of that. He's sick of being this rock poet who speaks to relevant political issues, but he doesn't know what to do next. He has no idea how to reinvent himself. And so he tells his manager that he's quitting the music business, that he's done with the singing, done with the songwriting. He's going to move to this remote cabin in upstate New York, and he's going to paint and write his novel. Didn't even bring his guitar. And so he's there for a couple days and you know, not writing any music. He feels free. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he gets this itch. He says it's like the ghost takes over his mind. And the ghost just begins writing and writing and writing. And he describes it as like this vomit of words coming out of him. Vomit is his verb. And he can't stop it. He needs to get it out. It's this uncontrollable insight. And over the next few hours, he writes more than 25 pages of ambiguous, vague, obscure lyrics. But within those 25 pages are the lyrics to Like a Rolling Stone. And it's that song, that six-minute rock single, that would really reinvent Bob Dylan's career, that would show himself, that would allow him to, you know, that showed Bob Dylan what he was actually capable of.
So you're saying that he actually found a different way of doing music, of writing a song.
Exactly. I mean, Like a Rolling Stone broke every rule in the rock and roll business. It was way too long. It was 6 minutes. It was not a transparent love song. It was not clear at all what Bob Dylan was singing about. It was full of obscure rhymes, lyrics that made no sense. It was this collage of influences. You know, for the first time, Bob Dylan could really bring together all its influences. So there was a bit of Fellini, a little Brecht, some Robert Johnson, some Woody Guthrie, all these different influences for the first time coalesced in this one song. And I think that's really what made Like a Rolling Stone so influential, not just for Bob Dylan, but for every other rock and roll artist since.
Now, what's striking about the story is that he got stuck. I mean, he got to a point where he felt like he couldn't go anymore, but somehow the getting stuck seemed to be essential to moving on to the next level.
Exactly. It came at his darkest moment. It came when he quit. It came when he hit the wall, when he had no idea what else to do. And then it came out of the blue. And when it arrived, it felt like a revelation. It came attached with this feeling of certainty. And those are both defining features of this very particular creative moment called a moment of insight. And the defining features of this moment, as defined by psychologists over the last few decades, are, one, the answer comes out of the blue. The answer comes when we least expect it. The answer comes often after we've been stumped, after we've been blocked, after we've basically given up. And then once it arrives, it feels like the answer. We don't have to double check the math or reread the lyrics. We know this is what we've been waiting for. Now, it's a very, very mysterious mental phenomenon. It's if the cortex is sharing one of its secrets. And yet, psychologists and neuroscientists have found some very interesting ways to study it and to really understand how the brain engineers these epiphanies.
So what's your guess as to what might have happened in Bob Dylan's brain? What parts of the brain might have been activated?
Yeah. Well, it's tough, obviously, to speculate on Bob Dylan's brain in particular. But what scientists have, because that's a special 3 pounds of
there
jello.
Might not be any other brain like that.
But boy, it'd be fun to get him in an fMRI machine. But what scientists have found, and they've been forced to study moments of insight in some very clever ways, because obviously you can't just put undergrads in a brain scanner and say, okay, have a breakthrough, you know, do it now. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So instead, what they do is they give students, they give undergrads, they give their subjects a series of creative puzzles, which are often solved in moments of insight. And that allows them to study the underlying brain substrate behind these moments of insight. And what they discover is that a few seconds before the insight appears, there's typically a sharp spike in activity in a part of the brain called the superior anterior temporal gyrus. It's a part of the brain nobody knows too much about. It's in the back of your right hemisphere, just behind the ear. It's previously associated with things like the processing of jokes and the interpretation of metaphors. And what it seems to be particularly good at is drawing together remote associations. So looking at two ideas that seem completely unrelated, seem like they have nothing in common. You know, what this one brain area seems to be good at is finding that thin thread they actually share. So it's able to draw together seemingly disparate and unconnected ideas, disconnected ideas, and find the connection between them. When you need an insight, that's often a very, very important talent.
Yeah. Well, there's this thinking that's emerged about the different sides of the brain. And I know you're not just talking about left hemisphere, right hemisphere, but the thinking seems to be that the right hemisphere can sometimes make connections that weren't there before, whereas the left hemisphere is more analytical. You know, that's where you often are trying to work out a problem.
Yeah, so there's this pop cliche about, you know, the left hemisphere is all rational and mathematical and the right hemisphere is flighty and artistic and imaginative. And that's certainly an oversimplification. But in an interesting and somewhat ironic twist, scientists in recent years have actually confirmed the fact that our hemispheres do process information differently, that they do have different tendencies. And to make a long story short, the right hemisphere just seems to be a little bit more interested in the forest, and the left hemisphere is a little more granular, a little bit more interested in seeing the trees. And both perspectives can be very important, essential at different parts of the creative process. But when you need a moment of insight, when you're in a rural cabin in Woodstock, New York, and you're trying to figure out how to write a new kind of song, you probably want to lean a little bit more heavily on your right hemisphere.
Of course, the question is, how do we do that? I mean, how do we tap into that more intuitive side of our mind?
Well, I think that's where things get interesting and somewhat counterintuitive. What scientists have also found is that people are much more likely to solve these insight puzzles when they're relaxed, when their brain is full of a state that you can measure on an EEG machine called alpha waves. Alpha waves are still pretty mysterious, but they are closely associated with states of relaxation. And the reason relaxation seems to be so important for generating moments of insight is when we're not relaxed, when we're really attentive, when we're really focused, when we're fixated on the problem, our attention is out there. You know, we're really vigilant. And so the problem itself and maybe even a wrong answer is looping like a broken record inside our head. And we're not making lots of progress. And it's not until we're relaxed, until we're, you know, in the hot shower or on a leisurely walk or taking a nap on the couch in the corner of the sunny room, that we're finally able to relax and turn the spotlight of attention inwards. And it's then, at long last, that we finally hear that quiet voice in the back of our head telling us the answer, giving us the insight.
Well, there are some fascinating implications to this. I mean, if you work in an office, for instance, where you are supposed to be doing creative work, and, you know, chances are you're going to be focused, you know, very intently at the task at hand. But you're saying it's maybe you need to actually get away from that for a while.
Yeah, that's exactly backwards. I think we've got this very narrow notion of what productivity is, that productivity is being well caffeinated and being chained to your desk and staring at your computer screen. But when you're solving really hard problems and when you get stuck on that problem, that's the worst possible thing you can do. It's in moments like that that you should get up from your desk and take that walk, take that hot shower, play some ping pong, do whatever it is you need to do to get relaxed. There's this great line of Einstein's, which is that creativity is the residue of time wasted. And I think, you know, I think that captures a lot of wisdom, that sometimes we need to get better at wasting time.
You tell some great stories of breakthroughs in all kinds of walks of life. One has to do with an engineer at 3M named Arthur Fry. What did he manage to come up with?
He managed to invent this product. You may have heard of it. It's called the Post-it Note. And he came up with it in a very, very interesting way. So 3M, for several years before Arthur Fry invents the Post-it Note, there'd been this guy, Sheldon Silver, who had been working on a very weak glue. He'd been working on developing an adhesive that was so weak, it barely stuck things together. And engineers at 3M had this vague intuition that this might be useful, but no one could figure out what it could be used for. Because after all, if you want to use a glue, it's generally because you want things to actually stick together. So what's the advantage of a glue that doesn't actually work very well? So no one could figure out what to do with it. And so the product had languished on the shelves for several years at that point. Fast forward, Arthur Fry, he sings in his church choir. And he's got this annoying problem where he puts bookmarks in his choral book to mark the pages that are going to, to mark the pages that feature the songs that he's going to sing that week. But as he turns the pages and holds the book, these bookmarks often fall out. And that's very frustrating to him. So one Sunday, he's listening to a sermon, and it's a particularly tedious sermon that week. And he starts to daydream. His mind wanders off. And it's at this point that he connects his problem, his bookmark problem, trying to fix, the bookmarks in his choral book, to this very weak glue he'd heard about the week before at 3M. And all of a sudden he realizes that what he needs to do is coat his bookmarks in this very weak glue. And maybe, just maybe, the glue will be so weak that it'll stick the bookmarks to the pages, but won't tear the pages when he wants to move the bookmarks around. So it's, in a sense, a temporary fastener, a temporary stick for these bookmarks. And he then spends the next few months tinkering with the product, and eventually he realizes that if you really want to sell the product, it shouldn't be a bookmark. It should be a note that you can leave comments on and you can post to documents, because then people actually consume it. And a few years later, the Post-it Note is introduced and is now, of course, a staple of offices everywhere. But what makes that story so interesting to me is that it arrived in the midst of a daydream. It arrived not when Fry was at his office plugging away, but when he was listening to a slightly tedious sermon and just let his mind wander off.
Well, and
that's where the idea came from.
Yeah, and the implication is that boredom has its values. Sometimes you need to hit a spot where for whatever reason, your mind is taken away from the task at hand.
Absolutely, and this also explains why studies by Jonathan Schuller at UCSB have found that people who daydream more also score higher on tests of creativity. That, daydreaming is one of the first states of mind we drill out of our kids. In second grade, you're told, stop staring at the window, focus, focus, focus. But daydreaming is actually a really important mental mode. We spend, some studies estimate, up to half our life in the midst of a daydream. That the brain consumes tons of energy while daydreaming. It's because all these different brain areas are engaged in this elaborate crosstalk. And we're making new connections, we're mashing up ideas, we're exploring counterfactuals. It's a very rich kind of thought. And we should, we should encourage it. We should learn how to daydream productively. And I sometimes wonder if one of the reasons there are so many anecdotes now about people having their best ideas in the shower is because the shower is one of the last places we can't take our phones. We can't take our smartphones. And so we can't check our email, and we can't check Twitter, and we can't check Facebook. And so we're forced to actually daydream for a few minutes, while shampooing our hair without interrupting that process. And so maybe that's why the shower is this, this incubator of good ideas now.
Then there are other kinds of creativity that you also write about that would seem to tap into a different part of the brain. For instance, there was this legendary graphic designer, Milton Glaser, who came up with the slogan, I love New York, part of a big campaign to try to revive New York City in the 70s when things weren't going very well there. And he came at that problem, it would seem, in a very different way.
Milton Glaser has a very serious work ethic. He has actually stenciled into the door above his office, art is work. He is not big on these romantic epiphanies, the classic moment of insight. He believes you really solve problems by just thinking about them, by focusing on them, by obsessively drilling down and slowly unconcealing the graphic image you need to perfectly encapsulate that idea. And so when he was given this assignment of trying to come up with a graphic design that would carry the slogan, "I love New York," he spent a few days on it and worked really hard on coming up with this lovely cursive, friendly font, turns in his proposal. It's approved. Everybody likes it. But Milton Glaser, and this has happened to him several times before and since, couldn't get the idea out of his mind. He couldn't stop thinking about the problem. He was simply obsessed with it. So he keeps on thinking about it and keeps on thinking about it and keeps on tinkering and tinkering and tinkering. And then one day, while he's stuck in traffic in Midtown Manhattan in the backseat of a taxi, he gets out his notepad and just continues to draw, continues to refine this design. And it's at that moment, as he's going over sketch after sketch after sketch, that he finally stumbles upon this idea of "I heart New York," where instead of it being "I love New York" all spelled out, it becomes a bit of a visual puzzle where the love is an actual heart, a graphic heart. And this is now, of course, one of the most widely imitated works of graphic design in the world.
So the moral here is that maybe you do need to persist and keep at it.
Yeah, the moral here is that you can also invent new things and come up with new ideas in the completely opposite approach, where instead of distracting yourself, you simply invest in focus, you concentrate, and you slowly make new connections. These connections aren't going to be as big and as all-encompassing as those connections we make in that flash of insight, you know, while in the hot shower. They're going to feel more incremental, they're going to feel smaller, but we do have this sense of progress. We feel like the idea is, you know, is going somewhere, that we're getting somewhere interesting. Psychologists have this wonderfully evocative phrase for such feelings. They're called feelings of knowing. And I think, you know, the basic advice one can give out based on this research is that when you've got a feeling of knowing, when you feel like Milton Glaser that you're making progress on a problem, that the graphic design is slowly getting better, that the edits are improving the poem, that you're thinking better about your experiment, when you feel that sense of progress, then you should keep on investing in attention. You should try to focus. You should drink another cup of coffee. You should chug caffeine. Do whatever it is you need to do to stay focused. So trust that feeling of knowing. However, as soon as that feeling of knowing disappears, as soon as you no longer feel like you're making progress, that's when you need to start wasting some time. That's when you need to take a very long hot shower.
Well, you also cite the German philosopher Martin Heidegger, who had this phrase, the unconcealing process. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. I think that's Heidegger's fancy way of describing feelings of knowing, where, you know, he said a lot of what creativity is, and he got this from Nietzsche, who was also interested in exploding the romantic myth of creativity, that creativity was just about moments of insight. Nietzsche famously said, you know, artists have this vested interest in us believing in them, just channeling the muses, but really the secret of every great artist is that they're just a great worker. So he was not going to indulge any romantic myths about what artists were up to. And Heidegger was following in that vein, you know, said really what art and truth is all about, what worthwhile creativity is all about, it's about unconcealing something. It's about taking an idea which is cloaked and we can't quite see what the essence of it is, and then through endless hours of hard work and attention revealing it. And he said that doesn't happen most of the time out of the blue. It usually happens through hard work, through endless attention, which is like the solvent which reveals the thing we're trying to reveal.
You know, what's striking about the way you describe creativity, the science of creativity, is it's not exactly clear how to apply that in your own life, because there are different ways of doing this. I can just imagine, you know, someone reads your book and says, okay, I am in the creative business here. You know, what can I do to be more creative? Do you have any advice?
Well, creativity is complicated. And, you know, I wanted to do that complexity justice. I didn't want to oversimplify it and simply say creativity is just about moments of insight. So, you know, we should all leave our cubicles behind and take really long showers. Creativity is complicated, and different phases of the creative process are going to require different kinds of creative thinking. So sometimes you need to drink that triple espresso, and sometimes you need a moment of insight. And so I wanted to give people the tools to better diagnose their creative problems so they can structure their thoughts and structure their thinking accordingly. If we're looking for ways to boost our own creativity, individual creativity, I think it is important to get better at diagnosing our creative problems and tailoring our thought process. But I think the individual mind is only one part of creativity. I think a big part of creativity, which we often undervalue, is the teams we're associated with, the rooms we work inside, the offices we spend our days in, the cities we live in, the culture we're enmeshed within. All these factors beyond the individual, play a huge role in determining how creative we are.
And I suppose a lot of creative projects now really require this collaboration. They're bigger than what any one person can do.
Yeah, and the evidence suggests that creative collaboration is becoming more important. The economist Ben Jones has shown, and he's done this by data mining nearly 20 million peer-reviewed papers, that when you go back 50 years, the most highly cited papers in a field were almost always the product of a lone genius, a guy like Einstein or Darwin, someone who all by themselves saw farther than the rest of us. But fast forward to the 21st century, and now the most highly cited papers, those home run papers, they're almost always the product of a team. They are people from different fields coming together. And the main thing that's driving this effect is that our problems are getting harder, that they exceed the capability of the individual imagination. So we either have to learn how to work together or we're going to fail alone. So I think there is suggestive evidence that creativity is becoming more collaborative simply because our problems are getting harder.
Well, and you write about a sociologist at Northwestern named Brian Uzi, who has spent a lot of time trying to figure out what makes a group creative. And apparently he's come to some insights by studying Broadway musicals.
Yeah, this is a wonderful study. Spent several years constructing this vast social network of Broadway over the course of the 20th century. Looked at nearly 4,000 different musicals. And he was interested in looking at how the composition of the group, you know, every musical requires at least six different artists to work together, a choreographer, a librettist, a lyricist, and so on. And he was interested in how the social intimacy of that group, whether or not they knew each other really well, influenced the end creative output. And what he discovered is that social intimacy matters a lot, that it's really important whether or not you work with your friends or with strangers. Going into it, he assumed that all things being equal, it'd be better to work with good friends, that if you work, collaborate with your best friends, you'll have more freewheeling interactions, you'll be able to share information better, and so that'd be a good thing. He ranked every musical on this metric he called Q, so if it's a scale from 1 to 5, so if you've got a Q of 5, you're all best friends, basically. If you've got a Q of 1, you're all total strangers. And what he discovered, to his surprise, that plays with high Qs, so a Q near 4 or 5, they didn't do very well. They tended to bomb at the box office and were often panned by the critics. The same thing was true of plays with low Qs, so a Q near 1 or 2, they also didn't do very well. Instead, Uzi discovered that plays with a very small sweet spot of Q between 3.2 and 3.7 were somewhere between 2 and 4 times more likely to succeed and be praised by the critics. So that's a very, very big effect. This is not incremental. This is huge. 2 to 4 times more likely to succeed. And generally, these plays took on the same template. So you had a few repeat collaborators, people who'd worked together many times before, but then they bring in a couple total strangers, and that puts their Q in this sweet spot, which makes them so much more likely to succeed. His favorite case study is West Side Story, which featured several repeat collaborators, Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Lorenz, people like that. But they had the insight that they needed to bring on a fresh voice, and so they chose this lyricist, this 25-year-old lyricist who had never written for Broadway before, and his name was Stephen Sondheim. And it's the introduction of Stephen Sondheim that puts West Side Story in that sweet spot of Q. So I think when composing a team, when assigning a group to work on a problem, it's really important to seek out those Stephen Sondheim figures, to seek out that fresh voice, because that fresh voice is going to make a big, big difference.
Hmm. Well, this also raises questions about how groups can come together to cook up some new idea. And every office knows about brainstorming, you know. Every business has brainstorming sessions, you know, how to do this. But you say that actually most brainstorming is not very effective.
Yes, brainstorming is a technique pioneered by Alex Osborne. He was a Don Draper-like figure, the head of BBDO in his day in the late 40s and early 50s. In a series of best-selling books, he introduces this idea called brainstorming. Very simple technique. The first rule of brainstorming is thou shalt not criticize. Whatever you do, don't criticize, because the imagination is very meek and very shy. And if it's worried about being criticized, it'll just clam up. So you can't criticize. That kills the imagination. Brainstorming has since gone on to become one of the most popular creativity techniques of all time. It's used in boardrooms and advertising offices and schools and design offices. Whenever we want to come together to create an idea, we often talk about brainstorming. The only problem with brainstorming, because it is a feel-good technique. You know, it's nice not being criticized. We can all feel very productive because we can fill a whiteboard with our free associations. No one said their feelings hurt. The only problem with brainstorming, though, is that it just doesn't work. Study after study has shown that brainstorming actually gets in the way, that people do better working on their own than they do coming together to solve problems in this using this technique called brainstorming. Now, the reason brainstorming doesn't work gets back to that very first rule, which is thou shalt not criticize. Studies led by Charlene Namath at UC Berkeley have consistently shown that when people engage in acts of debate and dissent, they actually solve problems better, they have more ideas, and these ideas are rated as better by an independent panel of judges. So there's something about criticism, about constructive criticism, that instead of shutting down the imagination, it really draws it out, forces us to engage, forces us to listen, really means there's some skin in the game. It wakes us up. And that's a good thing. And so she argues that you know, the real problem with brainstorming is the fact that instead of kind of unleashing the imagination, it's just a little bit boring. It doesn't fully stimulate us. Instead, debate and dissent do.
But doesn't it depend on what kind of criticism you offer? Because so often criticism does shut down the conversation and people don't want to participate then.
Bushy argues, you know, the criticism should be constructive. It should never be personal. And you know, obviously, this is a very tough thing to manage. So I think that's the challenge, obviously, with encouraging people to engage in acts of debate and dissent. It's ensuring that it doesn't get too personal. But what she's found is actually that debate and dissent do the opposite, that they don't shut us down in general, that they really do wake us up. One of her most interesting findings comes when, after the experiment is over, a few hours later, she then brings people back into her lab and she says, okay, since the study was over, and you know, in a typical study, she might ask people to come up with ways to reduce traffic in the Bay Area, for instance, the San Francisco Bay Area. She'll say, okay, since the study is over, have you had any more new ideas since? You know, we haven't been asking you to think about it, but just, is the problem still in your head? Are you still mulling it over? Are you still ruminating on it? And what she finds is that people in the debate and dissent conditions have up to 7 times more new ideas than those in the brainstorming conditions, that they can't stop thinking about it, that there's something very motivating about being in an atmosphere that features debate and dissent.
You say Pixar, the Hollywood studio that makes animated movies, is very good at this kind of thing, sort of coming together and having brainstorming sessions, but in a sort of creatively, critically constructive way.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to spend some time at Pixar and got to delve into their process. And they absolutely believe in the value of debate and dissent. They call it plussing. And their basic mechanism is that, you know, when you review some footage, when you come together to make a scene better, that when you criticize it, when you offer your suggestions, you also offer a plus. You offer a suggestion not just on why it's bad, but also how to make it a bit better. So they absolutely believe in it. And Leon Grinch, who's the director of Toy Story 3, he had this great line he told me, which is, you know, too many places, too many creative places are about failure avoidance, that they assume the way to succeed is to simply avoid failure. When in reality, the creative process is inevitably entangled with failure, that if you want to make something new, it's always going to involve lots of mistakes, lots of dead ends, lots of wrong turns. And that's why the secret at Pixar is all about finding those failures as fast as possible. It's about failing fast. Then the question becomes, well, how do you fail fast? And that's where criticism comes in. You fail fast by identifying those failures in a group, and then you come together to fix it. But you know, when you put it like that, Pixar, their process is all about iteration. It's all about spending 5 years going through thousands of drafts on this 90-minute cartoon. And to really, I think, successfully iterate, you have to be willing to tolerate criticism. It's sometimes our feelings are going to be hurt. Sometimes it's going to put us in a bad mood. But that's one of those trade-offs that's required to really be creative.
Now, we've been talking about creativity both in groups and at the individual level. What about at the societal level? Can we talk about that? I mean, can we, I don't know, make suggestions as to how the United States could improve its collective creativity?
I think we can. I mean, one of the case studies I use in the book is what sociologists refer to as ages of excess genius, which are these sudden flourishings of talent, Think of moments like ancient Athens or, you know, Renaissance Florence or Elizabethan England. These sudden periods where you don't just get Shakespeare living in London in the 1580s. You also get Christopher Marlowe and Francis Bacon and John Donne. You can go down the list. It's quite intimidating here. I mean, here are guys who basically invent modern English literature, and they're all living in the same city at the same time. So for a long time, these ages of excess genius have been very mysterious. But I think we're starting to see some themes that make them possible, that whenever you have an age of excess genius, we see the same mechanisms kind of underlying this flourishing. And there are themes like all these ages tend to have a vast expansion in the educational system. So the pool of human talent suddenly expands. So Shakespeare was the son of a glover. His father signed his name with a mark. But Shakespeare was being taught Latin at the age of eight. Because he was raised in Stratford, he was being taught by an Oxford-educated teacher for free. You also see new means of sharing information and storing information. So there was a sudden flourishing of the publishing industry in London in the 1570s and 1580s. So Shakespeare had access to stories for the first time, and he stole from these stories very, very freely. He didn't like inventing his own plots, and so he would take a mediocre melodrama like Hamlet and turn it into the Hamlet we all know today. So he was able to make these stories his own, but that required him to have access to the stories in the first place. You also see an investment in intellectual property. So patents for the first time were invented, you know, in Elizabethan England. So people took the idea of ideas seriously. So these are some of the themes I think we can extract from these ages of excess genius. But I think it's also important to point out that when you look at modern America, we actually are pretty good at inventing and creating a certain type of genius, and that's athletic genius. We are very good at pumping out athletes who can compete all over the world. You know, you go to basketball leagues in Europe, and they feature American basketball players, and Japanese baseball leagues feature American baseball players, and we win a lot at the Olympics. We are very good at pumping out athletic genius, And the only problem is we haven't taken those same processes, those same social mechanisms that make us so good at pumping out athletic genius. We haven't applied them yet to creative genius.
Why are we so good about creating great athletes?
Well, I think one can look at how we treat athletes. So we drive our kids to Little League and to AYSO, you know, youth soccer. Very, very early on, we really encourage them to play together. And if they show any talent, then we send them to more advanced leagues where they compete against other talented kids. And so, you know, they're really allowed to develop their talent in the right way. We encourage them to practice, to engage in the right kind of deliberate practice, to really work on their core skills. And then if they're really good, they may get a scholarship to high school and to college. So we're really investing in them now. They're going to spend tens of hours a week just working on this one skill. And then we've also built a system where professional teams are willing to spend millions of dollars on contracts for these unproven players, players who have never played in the NBA or Major League Baseball or the NFL, but they're still going to get very, very rich. They're still going to get millions of dollars worth of contracts. So these teams are willing to bet on their potential. And when you look at the system as a whole, you see that it is kind of the ideal way to develop talent. And that's why we're so good at creating athletic genius. We just have to apply, I think, some of those same lessons. And this is a metaphor, you know, first proposed by Bill James. He's the first guy. He's the inventor of sabermetrics, the pioneer of sabermetrics. And he was the first one to point out that America is very good at creating athletic genius. We're just not very good at creating any other kind of genius.
Well, it's interesting then to speculate about whether the same model would apply, let's say, to the schools to create academic geniuses, or whether the true geniuses have to drop out of school at a certain point to really be able to pursue their passion.
Well, you know, obviously part of the reason professional teams can, you know, can offer an 18-year-old a very lucrative contract is because that 18-year-old may draw people to an 80,000-seat stadium. People love watching sports. But I think people also love watching music. They love going to see Bob Dylan. They love reading novels. There is a real market for the arts. We just think have to get a little better about translating that market into educational institutions, showing kids at an early age that if you cultivate this talent, it can pay off. And so the first thing we cut from pre-K education and the first thing we cut from K through 12 education shouldn't be art classes. It shouldn't be music class. We should encourage kids to explore passions, to get a sense of flow, to to explore these arts. And maybe they'll discover they love it. Maybe they'll discover they're really talented at it. And then that becomes, you know, a endless source of creativity throughout their life.
I have one final question. Has working on this book, doing this research, influenced the way you think about your own creative work?
It has. I used to have this very puritanical notion of productivity where if I was stuck on something, if I couldn't figure out how to structure an article or a book chapter or write a sentence, I would force myself to sit at my desk until it was done. That was just the way I approached it. So, you know, I would sit there and grit my teeth and just get it done. And then, of course, I'd look at it the next day and realize that it actually wasted my time and my fix wasn't a fix at all, that it was a fake answer. Now when I hit the wall, when I get that block, I'm much more willing to take a nice hike. I'm much more willing to let myself take a nap, to let myself get relaxed, to go on a daydreaming walk. So I really have learned to embrace Einstein's credo of, you know, creativity is the residue of time wasted. I've gotten better at wasting time.
That is a great way to end it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this was terrific, and it's just a great book, so thanks.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Sounds good. Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.